This week, we are going to be looking at the first in two lessons. I know it's changed a little bit. I've gotten an extra week worth of time, so I'm going to take the English Reformation in two parts. So we're going to look at the English Reformation from the reign of Henry VIII through the reign of Elizabeth I, and then next week we will look at the Puritan movement and the Separatist movement and the beginning of Baptist and other various English dissenting religious movements that come about after the reign of, or during the reign of, Elizabeth I. So, to start off with, we're going to look at the difference really that exists between the English Reformation and reformations on the continent. So, by and large, when we think about the Reformation on the continent, so when we're thinking about Germany or Switzerland or even areas in France and the Netherlands and different places like that, what we're really seeing is it's going to be driven by people that are actively seeking to reform the church, reform the practices and eventually the doctrine of the church. And it's only going to be in the aftermath of this religious revolution that really takes place in these various areas that politics kind of become entangled in it. So in areas in Germany and France and Holland, all of these, even in places where there are exceptions, where in Denmark and Sweden, where the revolution is more political, it's going to have very real religious consequences. And so even in areas where it's a little bit more politically motivated, there are very real religious consequences, which is unlike the English Reformation, at least in the beginning. In England, the Reformation is really going to be driven and started by an exclusively political revolution. It's not religiously oriented. And any religious consequences that might have developed, or in fact tried to develop during this period of political revolution, are going to be actively resisted by the person who started the political revolution in the first place. So we're going to look at that. So, and this is going to lead to a very kind of unique church, since the English church is begun by a political decision, and it's really focused on politics. Most of what we're going to be talking about for a large part today, we will talk about some of the ways that the church develops religiously in England over the reign of the four people that we're going to be discussing today. But for the most part, we're really going to be looking at kind of the political workings that allowed the English church to exist. And then next week, we'll kind of look at how, once all that politics kind of gets out of the way, the English church is going to be free in a lot of ways to develop, and why it's able to develop that way. So the English church that's going to come into existence is going to be born out of a Catholic English church, obviously. And there are a number of different kind of characteristics that I want us to be familiar with about an English church. And this is going to be, the English church has a history of a sort of ambiguous relationship to Rome. So the English church is not going to be a church that is particularly, throughout its entire history, going to be tied to Rome. The English church is begun by people that don't even acknowledge the overlordship of Rome. It's begun by the Celtic church. So the Celtic church exists outside the kind of influence of Rome for a long time. And in fact, until the English, who eventually swear allegiance to the Roman see, actually go and conquer Ireland. And that's one of the reasons why they go and conquer Ireland, is so that they can subjugate the Irish church to Rome. Other issues, the issues of Henry II and his conflict with Thomas a Becket, John I and his conflict over papal appointments. He's going to be excommunicated and all of England will be placed under interdict for a long period of time. People like Wycliffe will come about during the period that we're going to be talking about, at least part of the early period of what we'll be talking about today. And they'll challenge Rome's ability to regulate and govern the church inside the English kingdom. So England does have a history of not being particularly attached to Rome. England also has a strong anti-clerical heritage. Especially during this later part of the Middle Ages, when the church becomes more and more corrupt, you'll have a peasants' revolt that erupts in England that in large part is motivated by anti-clerical feelings. It's also motivated by anti-noble feelings. But the same thing will happen to the peasants' revolt in England as happens to the peasants' revolt in Germany, although this one begins quite a bit before. You have people once again like Wycliffe who come out and speak against the excesses of the clergy. And then you'll have clergy members, especially at the beginning of the time period that we're talking about right now, that will be very, very worldly and will not be nearly as concerned with their role as the governing of the church as they are going to be concerned with political issues. These are going to be people like Cardinal Wolsey, who's going to be the papal legate in Britain, and he's also going to be Henry's chief counselor. And he's going to be very unpopular for a number of reasons. One, for his openly immoral life. He never even visits any of the bishoprics that he is kind of receiving money for being in charge of. He also lives openly with a concubine for a number of years and has at least two children with her. But even more than this kind of openly immoral life, what's going to bother the English people is that as the papal legate and as Henry's chief minister, he's going to revise the tax system and end up making people pay much more taxes than they were used to, which is always a way to make people upset at you. And they will take this out on the church more than they will take it out on Henry. Now, all this being said, the people in England, while they were not particularly attached to Rome, they were a very religious people. And over the course of years, through various revivals and different things like this, monastic revivals, the church had amassed a massive amount of power and land and wealth in England. Between one-third and one-fifth of all the land in England at the time of Henry VIII was owned by the church. The church also possessed special judicial and tax rights that had been given to them. And the king needed the power of the church in order to be able to rule England effectively. He needed to be able to have the church on his side to be able to rule England effectively. Anyone that controls at least about a third of the land in your entire country is going to be important to have on your side if you're the ruler. So even with this tradition of anti-clericism or ambiguous relationships with Rome, the effects of the Protestant Reformation when it begins are not very evident in England. You don't have a lot of Lutherans showing up. You have a few. They're persecuted, but not a lot. It doesn't really grab hold. It probably wouldn't have grabbed hold if political circumstances hadn't intervened. Another issue with the church is the church in England at this time is really going to be run by and large, for the most part, by Henry through his being able to control the people that he appoints as the head of the church. So through his ability to appoint the Archbishop of Canterbury, through his ability to control papal legates who come to England, he's going to be able to control, by and large, the church. And this would have remained an acceptable method of operation for Henry if things had continued on as they normally would. There would have been no need. Henry wasn't in any way financially motivated or some kind of the way that the rulers of Denmark or Sweden or maybe some of the German princes were financially motivated, in large part politically, maybe to adopt Protestantism. Henry's not going to be motivated by that. Henry is also, despite his personal life problems, is going to be a very religious, at least outwardly religious person. He will hear Mass at a usual rate of 5 times a day, unless he's hunting, and then he drops it down to 3. So he will hear Mass said 5 times a day, usually. He even wrote, he probably signed a treatise written by Thomas More that defended the Catholic sacraments against the teachings of Luther. And for this, the Pope awards him the title of the Defender of the Faith, which is going to be an irony considering what's going to take place after this. But Henry is a very, at least outwardly, loyal Catholic. He has no desire. He doesn't like Protestantism. He's never going to like Protestantism. He's never going to favor a Protestant form of religion, even after he separates from the church. But Henry is going to have problems that are going to cause him to be forced in a lot of ways into, at least in his mind, being forced into taking the church in England away from Rome. So the problems of these are going to be, we're going to look at these in each in part. So the recent War of the Roses, we're going to look at how that plays into this. His need for a successor, which is going to be tied to the War of the Roses. He's going to have an illegitimate marriage. We'll talk through that. He's going to have a new love interest, which is going to be a little bit different than some of the other ones, and that's going to be tied in, one, with his illegal marriage or his illegitimate marriage and his need for successor. This new love interest is going to play a part. And then, on top of all of that, even with all of those problems, he still might have been able to get out of his problems and keep the church in England attached together if it wasn't for problems that had developed in Rome at the same time. So let's look at these each in part. The War of the Roses is going to begin. Now, there are a lot of different ways of dating the War of the Roses. Typically, the War of the Roses, we say, begin in 1455 and lasts until 1485. It lasts for about 30 years. But if you want to really go back, the beginning of the problem with the War of the Roses goes all the way back to about 1319, when one of William the Conqueror's grandsons will be deposed by one of his other grandsons. And this is going to be the Richard II will be deposed by who will become Henry IV. And this is going to lead to a series of very destructive civil wars. And this is really going to take place beginning in 1455 between two rival branches of the Plantagenet family. That's the royal family of England at the time. And these are going to be the House of Lancaster, symbolized by a red rose, and the House of York, which is going to be symbolized by a white rose. And that's where we get our colorful title for the War of the Roses. And here's a scene from Shakespeare's play, Henry IV, in which the nobles of England are deciding in the garden of the king which side they're going to take by picking various roses off of rose bushes. So we have this problem that develops. And over the course of years, you're going to have kings that are going to be assassinated, kings that are going to be deposed, battles that will be fought. Tens of thousands of the English nobles will fight and die at various times. And England will go, really, from the most powerful, richest, best-run country in all of Europe at various times at the beginning of the War of the Roses, even in the midst of the War of the Roses. The English king, Henry VI, Henry VI, will actually conquer almost all of France. He'll have himself crowned as the heir apparent to the French king who's sick and dying. So the war, even the Hundred Years' War, which is going on at the same time as much of the War of the Roses, is going to be able to look like England's going to be able to win out of this, but it's not going to happen. Henry VI, in the midst of his triumph, will suddenly die. He'll leave a nine-month-old son. No, Henry V will leave a nine-month-old son. Henry VI, there it is. I was wrong. It's Henry V that conquers almost all of France. It's his son, Henry VI. There are a lot of Henrys, as we're going to see throughout all of this. It's easy to get some of them confused. Henry VI will only be 9 months old when he becomes king, and this is going to lead to another round of dynastic warfare as people within the English royal family struggle for power. It doesn't help that Henry VI probably also genetically contracted a version of insanity that had plagued the French royal family for a number of years. His mother was the daughter of the French king, and so this insanity line that had troubled the French royal family, the House of Valois, for a number of generations, is going to enter the English royal family. And at various times in his life, Henry VI will be mentally insane. He'll come out of it and go back into it again and again. But there are long periods during the War of the Roses. I want you to get this. It's not 30 years of constant warfare. There are periods where one English king seems to have established control over England and the war's over and everyone's going to be happy. And this period of peace might last for 10 or 15 years. And then another dynastic issue comes up. So when Henry VIII's father, Henry II or Henry Tudor, deposes the last Yorkish king, Richard III, at the Battle of Bosworth Field, it looks like the war's over, but no one really knows. Even though Henry VII marries the daughter of, or marries the best Yorkish claim to the throne and therefore unites the two claims together in one place, if by some chance Henry VII doesn't have a child that's able to become heir to the throne, or his son doesn't have a child that's able to succeed to the throne, this whole period of civil war and turmoil is likely to begin all over again. And this is what Henry is worried about. And Henry does not have, if we can move to the next slide, does not have what he would consider a strong heir to the throne. He has one legitimate child by his wife, Catherine of Aragon, Mary. And the problem is that up until this point, no English woman has ever sat on the throne of England. Only one point in English history, after the reign of Henry II, he appointed his daughter the Queen of England. As soon as he died, his cousin stepped up and took over the kingdom, and another period of civil war broke out before the War of the Roses. So it's obvious that Henry's just come through a period of civil war. England has just come through a period of civil war. His father has won it. Even Henry has had to put down a number of revolts that are based around Yorkist pretenders to the throne. And here he is with only one child, a girl. No woman has ever sat on the throne of England. And the last time someone tried it, another war broke out. So he's got two strikes against him as far as his daughter sitting on the throne. So it's going to be a problem. Now, he also has the problem of what he would consider to be an illegitimate marriage. His wife, Catherine of Aragon, who is the daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella, those are the people that sent Columbus across the ocean, actually had been contracted in marriage to Henry's older brother, Arthur, and had actually been married to him. They were married for a period of about four months. She claimed the marriage was never consummated, but regardless of the fact, this sort of being married to your brother's widow is something that the church law forbids. And Henry's father, once his oldest son dies, not wanting to give back the dowry that had been paid for her, decided, well, we'll just marry her off to the next son. And got a dispensation, from Rome, that's where the Pope says, there's this legal issue in church law, but I'm going to set it aside in this case because I'm the Pope and I can do what I want. And so that happens. Now, Henry views this marriage eventually. If she had produced a string of male heirs, there probably would have been no problem with the marriage. From all evidences, at least at the beginning, it was a relatively okay marriage. Nothing outside the bounds of what was normal for the time. I mean, Henry had a number of mistresses, but that wasn't necessarily terribly uncommon. But because she had a number of miscarriages, three sons were born that either died as a result of a miscarriage or died within a month or a week or a couple of days of being born. Henry began to view this marriage as being cursed by God because he had married his brother's widow and gone against church law. And this was the reason why I don't have a male heir. And by the time that we're going to get to the beginning of the controversy that's going to come about in 1525, Catherine is 40 years old and really past the point where she can have a child. So Henry's in trouble if he wants someone other than Mary to be his heir. And this is going to lead to a new love interest that's going to pop up on the scene. Anne Boleyn, whose sister had actually been one of Henry's former mistresses. She's one of the queen's maids in waiting. And unlike her sister, she refuses Henry's advances and says, I'm not going to satisfy you unless we're married. That's the way it's going to work. And of course, this does nothing to stop Henry's desires. It only makes him want her more. And so Henry is going to start actively seeking a way to get rid of his first wife and be able to then marry Anne Boleyn. So this is going to lead to what would be normal at the time. He's going to send his Cardinal Wolsey, the guy who's in charge of the church in England, off to Rome. Or Wolsey's going to send people off to Rome and they're going to go to the Pope and say, look, you know, this marriage isn't working out for us. We all know that it was contracted under less than real or legitimate means. So let's just call it quits and let the king marry the woman that he wants and we'll go back and everything will be fine. And this would have happened in 90% of the cases where a king wants to be released from a marriage, the Pope would have been more than willing, with a slight fee perhaps or some other sort of incentive, to let him off and let him marry who he wishes. But there are problems in Rome. If Clement VII, this is Pope Clement VII here, had overturned Henry's marriage, that would have meant that he was nullifying the previous decision of a previous pope. So he would have had to say, no, this other pope was wrong. And what he really had to say, in a sense, like legally, is that this other pope did not have the right to grant this dispensation. And that's just a legal precedent that the popes don't want to set. And on top of all of that, Clement II is the prisoner of Charles V at the time. Charles V has invaded Italy. He has sacked and captured Rome. Clement is his prisoner, and Charles just happens to be the nephew of Catherine and is not going to be disposed to allowing Clement to let his aunt be divorced. So the Pope will stall and say, well, maybe, and he'll send a legate up there to Britain to make the decision, but not actually give him the authority to make the decision. So he'll say, I'm sending someone up there to make the decision for you, and he'll tell the person you can't make the decision, so he'll just be there for no purpose. It's just a show. So Henry becomes frustrated with this, and he begins to seek a political solution to his problem. And he's going to call Parliament into session in 1529, and Parliament will begin passing a series of laws or legislations that allow, they give Henry, they don't enforce this, they allow the king to start making decisions to do what he wants with the church. Basically, the Parliament saying, whatever you want to do with the church, we're going to back you. And Henry is going to kind of use these as kind of trying to push the Pope into making the decision that he wants, because Henry doesn't want to break with the church. That's his last option. So he's going to try and use these to politically push the Pope. Oh, well, you know, I might leave, so maybe you need to think about giving me what I want. If you don't, you know, it's a bluff, basically, what he's doing. They're playing chicken with each other here. So he's going to use this compliant Parliament. He's also going to get rid of Wolsey. Wolsey would have been executed. He just had the good fortune to die first. And he's going to appoint new ministers in his place. He's going to put two people where Wolsey had been one person doing both of these people's jobs. He's going to appoint a guy by the name of, they're both first named Thomas, and they both start with C-R, so it can be a little bit confusing. So Thomas Cranmer is going to be the new Archbishop of Canterbury and the head of the English Church. He was previously the personal chaplain of the Boleyn family. And so he has Protestant leanings. And he's going to be the new Archbishop of Canterbury, and then he's going to appoint another guy by the name of Thomas Cromwell to be his chancellor or his chief political advisor. So both of these guys are going to be Protestant-leaning people. And suddenly you're going to start seeing Lutheran books start appearing in the English court and people spouting off Lutheran ideas and different things like this, trying to, in the English church, at least the people in charge of the English church and the people in charge of the English government, start slowly drifting away from the Catholic Church. And Henry's only too welcome to let this happen as long as this allows the Pope to make the decision he wants. But by 1533, he's going to be done with this act, and the Pope is not going to make the decision that Henry wants. So Henry, with the aid of Parliament, is going to first suspend payments to Rome, abolish all clerical appeals to Rome, and then finally, the Parliament is going to declare that all papal rights and privileges are going to be then transferred to Henry, and Henry is going to be named the supreme head of the English Church. And the English Church is going to be now officially split from the Catholic Church. Henry's marriage to Catherine will be voided by Cranmer. He will be married to Anne, and Catherine will be banished and spend the next 2 years of her life living in a castle comfortably in exile until she dies. So only 2 years, and this all would have been avoided if he had just been a little bit more patient. He'd already waited about 8 years from the time that this all kind of started this. But all that being said, 2 more years, it would have been over and done with anyway, but it didn't happen that way. So Henry is going to get his wish. He's going to have broken with Rome. So, but here's a couple of things about it. Now, resistance, you might assume that the people of England might be disturbed by this. We've broken our contact with Rome. The church has changed. Well, the way that the church looks has changed. The way that the church practices, we're going to talk about that, hasn't changed. There's really almost no resistance. There's a very small rebellion in the north of England where Catholicism is a little bit more firmly entrenched than in southern England. But that's that was very easy to put down. Only two people of any real importance in the kingdom, Thomas More, the former Chancellor of England, and a guy by the name of John Fisher, the Bishop of Rochester, are the only people of any importance that refuse to swear an oath to Henry as the supreme head of the church, and they're executed, and a number of other lesser people are executed that do the same thing. But it's really pretty bloodless and pretty easy. I think Henry's probably surprised by it, because most of the country either willingly or silently just go along with what Henry wants. It really doesn't change anything in their day-to-day lives, as we're going to see here, because Henry's church is not going to be Protestant. We should not think now that the church, the English church, has separated from Rome, that suddenly we are dealing with a Protestant England. We are not. England is not Protestant. We are dealing with just a England in which the Pope has been replaced by the King, but everything else at this point in time anyway is going to be the same. There are no changes doctrinally, practice-wise, organization, other than just the top person has changed. That's it. So the church is relatively the same. Henry will continue, after his split with Rome, to continue to persecute Protestants in his realm and outside of his realm. It's during this period of Henry, after Henry has broken with Rome, but yet is still pursuing a very Catholic policy, that William Tyndale will be hunted down in Brussels in Belgium and murdered and executed on Henry's orders. Tyndale is the man who, if you don't know, translates the first modern English New Testament. We've talked about people before. We've talked about Wycliffe. But Wycliffe is translating into what we call Middle English. Tyndale is the first modern English translation of the New Testament. And along with a guy by the name of Coverdale, their Bible that they're going to kind of do to... Coverdale will use Tyndale's New Testament in his translation of the Bible. About 80 or not, but somewhere between 80 and 90% of what we were going to know as the King James Version of the Bible will come from Tyndale and Coverdale. And it will really shape, in a large part, our modern English language is really shaped in a large part by Tyndale's translation of the Bible. He'll also, as soon as he gets word that there are any Anabaptists or other people in the country, he gives them 10 days to get out of the country or they're going to start being executed. So we should not view this as being Protestant, because he's going to continue to persecute Protestants. Now, because of the ease with which Henry is able to overthrow the Pope, he starts looking at, well, what else can I do? He doesn't want to change the church structure necessarily, but he's like, are there any other things that I can do politically to help myself out? Now, like we said, the church controlled about a third of the land in England, and now Henry is the head of the church, so Henry can do with that land whatever he wants. And what he's going to begin doing is he's going to begin dissolving all the monasteries in England. Now, this is going to be a slow process. Here's a map of just the nunneries in England. This would not have been all the monasteries. There would have been far more monasteries than there would be nunneries, but you can just see the massive amount of nunneries that there are, let alone all the monasteries that would have existed outside of these. Now, he's going to begin with the small ones. In 1535, just 2 years after his official break with Rome, he's going to start sending representatives around that are going to kind of start looking over the monasteries, looking for any sort of irregularities in their practices or their finances, any sort of justification. And he is going to, in 1535, just shut down all the small ones. And we're talking about ones that have an annual kind of income of about less than 200 pounds. Very small. He's going to get rid of those. They're not really doing a whole lot. And then what's going to happen is, very surprisingly, most of the large monasteries in England are going to begin voluntarily dissolving themselves. Now, there are a lot of reasons why this could happen. Many of them reason that they might be suppressed and dissolved anyway, and they might as well go ahead and do it on their own terms when they might get better terms when they're forced to do it. Many houses were in poor financial situations. We looked at this earlier, but because of the way that their endowments were spread out over the place, they weren't consolidated anymore in a large part. It was very hard to run them and not very cost effective in a lot of situations. And because of the wealth that they had accumulated and the manner of living to which they had grown accustomed to living, their ability to support people in this extravagant lifestyle cost a lot, so they were able to only, you know, support less and less people in this sort of lifestyle. So they were in, a lot of them were in poor financial situations. And a lot of monks were just, and nuns were happy to be able to leave. Many, you have to remember, many of these would have been second, third, fourth children of nobles. It would have been forced into monastic orders or holy orders. So they were only too happy to leave. So by 1539, about takes about 4 years, by 1539, all the monastic land in England is going to be owned by the crown. Now, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to be done with this land. Some of it's going to be used to provide pensions and dowries for the monks and nuns who are now out of a place to live. So they're going to be given a job or a pension from the crown, or they're going to be given a dowry if they want to get married. Some small portion of it will be used to start founding educational institutions. Christ College at Oxford, I believe, is founded out of this endowment. There are a number of other little schools, but not a lot. The majority of the wealth of the monastery, of course, finds its way into Henry's pocket. The revenue of the English crown increased by about £100,000, because of this, and that's a lot of money at the time, a massive amount of money. So Henry's going to get most of that land for him, that money for himself. So now what Henry comes into contact with, though, is when he begins making these little changes, he's going to run into what the problem of the Reformation is. And we've talked about this before. The problem of the Reformation is that once you start changing things, even if you have no intention, right? Henry just changes a little bitty thing, just who's at the top. I don't want to change anything else. But once change starts, no matter how subtle and how small it is, once that boulder starts rolling down the hill, Henry's going to have to work very, very hard to try and stop it from going somewhere that he doesn't want to go. And it's going to bring out the crazy, but we won't get to the crazies for a long time in England because they're going to be suppressed for a while. But there are going to start being changes that take place that we're going to start noticing. In 1540, the Bible, ironically, Tyndale and Coverdale's Bible is going to be put in all the English churches by the order of Henry. So the man that he executed and the other man that he drove out of England, he's going to say, well, we'll just use their Bible and put it in all the churches. So their Bibles will be put in all the churches. Cramer is already married at this time, although probably Henry doesn't know about it. But other priests are going to start being able to be secretly married. And Cramer's ideas during this time, remember, Cramer is the head of the English church. His ideas are going to continue to mature, and he's going to start changing his ideas on transubstantiation and the real presence of Christ in the bread and wine and a number of other things, justification by faith alone. A lot of these ideas, he's going to start moving in more Protestant directions. Cranmer is. Cromwell will too. Cromwell is a very Protestant-minded person. And they're going to start slowly trying to push the king into more Protestant direction. But Henry is going to resist this, and this is going to come about at about the same time that, unfortunately, Cromwell makes an unfortunate marriage match for Henry, and that he gets a German noble lady, Anne of Cleves, to come over to England and marry Henry. Unfortunately, Henry's not very satisfied with the way that she looks. So he has to marry her because the marriage has been already contracted, and it would be an embarrassment not to, but he divorces her relatively quickly. This would be Henry's fourth wife. So Anne of Boleyn is already out the picture. Jane Seymour, who actually is going to give Henry his only male heir, the future Edward VI, will die later in complications due to childbirth, and so he'll be again without a wife. Anne Boleyn will be beheaded for treason eventually. So he has this new wife. And so because of this unfortunate mistake of picking an ugly wife for Henry, Henry's actually going to end up liking Anne of Cleves. She's going to stay in England. He's going to give her a lot of land as compensation for breaking off the marriage and everything. And he's going to call her his beloved sister. And she's going to be around him, and she's going to be an advisor to him, and she'll be there, and she's going to be honored only below whoever the current queen is and his daughters and children. So Anne of Cleves will stay in England and be important, but she's not going to be romantically involved with Henry. Henry was probably happy to finally find a woman that was compliant if he wanted to divorce her and didn't make a big stink about it. So, but Henry, at this time period, because of all this that's going on, Cromwell falls out of favor. He's going to start pushing back on Cranmer and Cromwell's reform issues. The Bibles that had been previously allowed to be in English are now only going to be allowed to be read by the priests. Cranmer is going to be forced to send away his wife. She's going to be sent away to the continent for about 4 years to keep her. Cromwell's going to be executed. Cranmer's going to be accused of treason. Now, Cranmer is an interesting man because Cranmer seems to be able to get along with just about anyone and kind of be liked by everyone other than the one person eventually who's going to kill him. But Henry famously tells Cranmer as they're sailing down the Thames River, jestingly, "I now know who the biggest heretic in Kent is, and it's you, and I'm okay with that." So Cranmer, even though Henry realizes that Cranmer's theological ideas aren't his theological ideas, he keeps him around because Cranmer, one, he likes him, and two, Cranmer's primary loyalty lies to the king and not to his theological issues at the time. Also, what's going to be called the Six Articles are going to be passed in 1539. And these articles are going to reinstigate the policy of transubstantiation, private masses, confessions, clerical celibacy, all these ideas. Basically, what Henry's doing is he's creating an Anglo-Catholic church. It's a Catholic church with just Henry at the top. It looks Catholic. It is Catholic. Everything about it's Catholic, other than the person in charge is not the Pope. It's Henry. That's what he's after. Now, unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately for the Protestant people who are having to react to this, Henry is very ill. Henry was injured in a jousting accident in 1535. He never really recovered from that. A lot of people have speculated that he might have had some sort of brain damage from it. He definitely developed a wound in his leg that would not heal. And he's going to go downhill from there. He's gonna live for another 12 years, but those are going to be the worst 12 years of his life. And this is also the 12 years of his life where he's most mentally unstable. And a lot of what we consider to be kind of the oddities that go on with Henry, his changing wives, having them executed right and left, is all going to come from this period. So there might be reasons why he was like that, that aren't just personality issues, but maybe some psychological issues that are going on with him. But that's hard to say. He's going to die at the age of 55 in 1447, and his son, Edward VI, is going to come to the throne. Now, Edward VI, despite all of Henry's desire to have an English Catholic church, has been raised, fostered, and tutored by Protestants. And Edward is going to be a staunchly Protestant person. And with him and the men around him who are going to run England while he's a child when all this begins, they're going to begin really starting to move the church away from a Catholic model and towards a more reformed model. So communion in both kinds, images are going to be taken out of churches, clerical marriage is going to be allowed, and the mass or the worship is going to be said in English and not in Latin. So all this is going to go on. Also during this time period, Cranmer is going to write the English Prayer Book, which is going to be a work of great literary genius. Things that we still talk about and think about and say to have and to hold, all these types of marriage ceremonies that we're accustomed with, are all written by Cranmer in the Book of Common Prayer and a number of other different things that we do. It's very Lutheran in a lot of ways, and by that I don't mean necessarily theologically, although it is theologically very Lutheran, because that's where Cranmer is at the time that he writes it. But it's this conservative mindset that's Lutheran, right? That I don't get rid of something unless the Bible tells me that it's wrong. Everything else is okay. So the way that the priests dress, the way that the service is conducted, all that kind of stuff is very conservative. He's only changing things that are blatantly wrong with the English service. Now, the first prayer book that comes out in 1549 is going to lead to a lot of dissatisfaction. Even Cranmer is going to be dissatisfied by the time the book comes out. His theological ideas have already shifted away from what he wrote in the prayer book. And so you're going to have a revision that's going to move in an even more reformed way, in which the real presence of Christ in the bread and wine is going to be denied, and it's going to move more towards a Zwinglian or Calvinist mindset. And the English prayer book and all the stuff that's going to come out during this time period is very, very reformed minded, very influenced by reformed people on the continent. Unfortunately for England, even though this is a great period of kind of international cooperation, we have a lot of foreign theologians that come here. Martin Bucer comes to England. The Italian Vermigli comes to England. The Polish person, Lasco, comes to England. All these are famous Protestant thinkers that are going to be brought to England and offered positions in the English schools and universities. And they're going to teach a new generation of English scholars Protestant ideas. Going to further emphasize and ingrain Protestant ideas in the educated upper crust of England. But there's a problem. The problem of succession, again. Edward is a sick child. He's always been sick. Most people believe that he suffers from tuberculosis. He has no heir. He's not married. And he's going to die at the age of 15. And that's going to lead to Mary. And Mary is going to be the daughter of Catherine of Aragon and Henry. And make no doubt that she is a devout Catholic. And she is going to seek to purge England that for the last few years has been moving in a very Protestant direction very, very quickly. She's going to seek to stamp out that heresy and not just return the church back to the church that her father created, but she's going to seek to turn it back all the way back to its allegiance to Rome. And the interesting thing about this, I titled this The End of Catholicism. You might think that, why would that be? She's returning it to Catholicism. And she does. The papal legate comes back, all this other stuff. But because of the way that Mary goes about it and because of the things that have gone on beforehand, Mary's reaction to Protestantism is going to shift people's view of Protestantism. And it's going to make people that might, when Edward the VI dies, England is still a very Catholic country. The only people that are really Reformed or Protestant are the educated upper crust that would have been literate, that would have read and have access to reading. The majority of poor, illiterate people, which would have made up the lion's share of the population, would have still been very Catholic in their understanding and Catholic in their religious practices and Catholic in their desires and all these things that they had wanted. And they would have been upset with the way that the church was moving, and they were. And they viewed Protestants as image smashers, right? Destructors, thieves who take things from the church and different things like this. Protestantism has a bad name among the majority of the English population at the time that Mary comes to the throne. But that's going to change because of the way that Mary deals with the Protestants and the way that the Protestants respond. I think that Mary came to the throne thinking that Protestantism was only a very superficial thing, that she could just kind of scrape that off the surface and she'd have a Catholic country again. But this is not going to happen. And the way she's going to go about doing this is through executions. And this gives her the name that we all know her by, Bloody Mary. The first execution is going to begin in 1555. And over the next 3 years of her reign, about 300 people are going to be executed in some way. Most famously is the story of Cranmer. Cranmer is not necessarily noted for his strong kind of will and being able to stand up to people, like he was never really able to stand up to Henry in a lot of ways. And so when Mary comes back to the throne, Cranmer is arrested. He recants all of his Protestant heresies, says, no, I want to go back to Rome. And he does. He's brought back to the Roman church. But Mary wants to make an example out of him anyway. So she's still going to execute him. So Cranmer signed all this his you know, recantings and all this other stuff. And he's brought to the church to give his, like, kind of last sermon before he's led off to be executed. And he gives a very pious sermon in which he, you know, talks about serving the king and country and queen and different things like this. And then he goes off in a completely unscripted direction and says, I recant all my recants. And I do not favor the Pope. I do not favor Mary, all these other things. And not only that, but when I get to the pyre, the hand that signed my recantations, I will stick that into the fire first and let it burn off. And he does. And here's a picture of him in the midst of it. He does stick his right hand into the fire and allow that to burn before the rest of him burns. So what Mary discovers, though, in all of this, what this does is this gives kind of the Protestants in a lot of ways, what it's going to do is it's going to make the Protestants identify in their mind the people who they think are Protestants as no longer church robbers and vandals and image smashers and all these other things, but they're going to start being identified with virtue and honesty and then a patriotic resistance to this half-foreign government that Mary's government really is, because Mary has married the King of Spain. And the King of Spain is now the King of England as well as the King of Spain. And so there's a lot of political turmoil that's going along in this as well. And the majority of the people in England are going to start favoring Protestants, looking up to them, where before they had been looked down on. This is going to change. And Mary really makes a miscalculation, and she really swings the way that England is flowing from kind of the intellectual crust we're moving towards Protestantism, but now the majority of the people are going to start favoring Protestantism. And Mary has a problem as well. Once again, it's the problem that all monarchies face. It's the problem of succession. When she becomes queen, she's 37. And even though she gets married, and even though at one point she thinks she's pregnant and she's not, she is not able to produce an heir. And so the Protestants in England and the Protestants that have fled to Europe in exile are only too happy to bide their time, knowing that sooner or later, Mary will die, and that England will be returned to Protestant rule, which is in fact what happens with the coming of Elizabeth I. Now, Elizabeth I is kind of an anomaly. She's an interesting lady in a lot of ways. Now, she's forced into the Protestant camp because Rome refuses to acknowledge her mother as the wife of Henry, and therefore she's illegitimate. And if she's illegitimate, she can't be the Queen of England. So she's really forced into the Protestant camp. She's not a religious zealot in any sense, not like her brother who is a very devout Protestant. She is not going to be that way. And she's also the queen of a polarized nation. What's happened is Protestants and the people who now favor them have become more Protestant than they were at the beginning of Mary's reign. And people that were pro-Catholic have become more Catholic. So you really have a split nation. And not only this, but Elizabeth is going to be forced to, and we'll talk about this in a second, I'll just hold off on that if I get to it. So, what she's going to be, though, is a reluctant reformer. She is going to be forced by the Protestants, who she has to have backing her, to institute a lot of changes that she might not necessarily want. What she wants is a return to her father's Anglo-Catholicism. But she's not going to be allowed to do that because she needs the support of the Protestants, and the Protestants are going to force her to go further down the road in Protestantism than she might have wanted, but that's just going to be the way it is. And she's going to be very, very good at never showing her feelings. If you can go to the next slide, the famous quote by the Spanish ambassador was that she's a woman and, of course, she's inconsistent. But I think a lot of times, Elizabeth's inconsistency was a very clever way of never committing herself and ending up in one camp or the other, because she had to straddle these two worlds that she was a part of. A people that both, some were Catholic and some were Protestant. A country that's surrounded at the time by Catholic nations. Scotland to the north, although she'll change that through her foreign policy. And then France and Spain, the two closest foreign countries to her, are both going to be Catholic. And she has to at least in some way keep an alliance with one of those. She's going to choose Spain at this time, to try and hold off France from sending Mary, who was also the Queen of France at the time, who also had a claim to the English throne, back to England in supporting her. So she had to use kind of Catholic Spain to shield off Catholic France. And to do that, she couldn't appear like she was too Protestant. But if she appeared like she was too Catholic, she'd lose the support of her Protestant subjects, and she would be out of support from them. And so she's in a very precarious situation, but she is very crafty and good at telling people what they want to hear or believe. And what she's going to do is she's going to create a compromise that is going to finally put Protestantism firmly in place in England, but it's not going to be a real reforming Protestantism. But what it is going to do is it is going to set the stage for real reform inside Protestantism in England to happen. And in a lot of ways, you can say that the Reformation in England only really begins when Elizabeth comes to the throne and the people are finally free from outside worries and cares, because Elizabeth is going to have a very, very long reign. Unlike all of her predecessors, except for her father, had a relatively long reign, but her brother and sister both had short reigns. So we're going to have this long period in which Protestantism is going to be able to be entrenched in England, and it's going to be here that we're going to start seeing Reformation take place within the English church, but it's going to take place in a way that's very different from the other places that we've seen in Europe. And we'll talk about that and the Puritanism and separatism and the beginnings of Baptist history next week. All right, does anyone have any questions? Okay. All right. Thanks, guys. You're dismissed.